So welcome to this panel on Amherst in the Amazon. I'm Kate Sims, Associate Professor of Economics and Environmental Studies here at the college. And yes, as of 2009, you can now major in Environmental Studies at Amherst College. We're very happy about this. And in fact, we just are joined this year by our first full-time tenure track hire in Environmental Studies, Ashwin Ravikumar. Woohoo. And appropriately, he has left campus to go do field work in the Peruvian Amazon, so he wasn't able to join us today. But we are joined by John Reed from the class of 88, and Foster, yep, whoop. Okay, he's got a good fan club, I see. And Foster Butch Brown from the class of 73. I'm really thrilled to have a chance to moderate this panel. My own work actually evaluates the impacts of conservation policies, including protected areas, payments for ecosystem services, and community forestry, all from an economic perspective. And I focused on how changes in management types or programs, program targeting, can better achieve environmental protection and local economic development, and have conducted research on policies in Thailand, Mexico, Nepal, and New England. And all of those regions share unique and important forest resources, but there is no region that is as unique and as important for global environmental and cultural heritage as the Amazon. So I am really looking forward to learning more today from our panelists. So our plan is that each speaker is going to speak for about 7 to 10 minutes, maybe a little longer, because unfortunately Jonathan just told us a few moments ago that he's unable to make the panel, so we have a little bit of extra time for our speakers. And then we're going to try to open it up as much as we can for questions and discussion with you all. I gave our panelists a couple prompts, asking them just to reflect first on some of the positive steps that they have taken to protect the Amazon. And I'm just going to show you a couple maps while I introduce these folks. Perhaps if we could dim the lights slightly, that will help with our maps and images. Thanks, John. So I asked them to reflect on these positive steps that they've taken to protect the Amazon. And this map shows some of the challenges facing the Amazon. So this shows areas of deforestation over different time periods from the 1970s until today. And you can see that there have been major areas of loss within the Amazon. But at the same time, on the good news side, you can see that a lot of areas within the Amazon have been protected. This is a map of all of the indigenous areas and protected areas that are now established within the Amazon. So I also asked them to reflect on some of the most pressing challenges that they continue to face in their work in protecting the Amazon, and to share with us what continues to help them be motivated to go further with that work into the future.
What's the legend?
So the red is protected areas and the green is the indigenous reserves. The basic message here, I know you can't read the legend, is just to get an idea for the fact that a lot of this area is covered now by protected areas, at least on paper. Returning just to our particular panelists, I want to take a moment to introduce them and tell you a little bit about them. So let me first just acknowledge Jonathan Putnam, who wasn't able to be here today, but is an international park affairs specialist in the U.S. National Park Service. And although he wasn't able to be here, he wanted to make sure that you knew how to find some information on what he's been working on. And he did send these links, which I'm happy to further share with anyone after the panel. He's been with the National Park Service for more than 17 years, working to promote the international mission of the U.S. National Park Service, facilitating cooperation between the National Park Service and other countries in order to protect National Park Service resources, such as migratory species, and to further conservation of natural and cultural heritage around the globe. He's a graduate of the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and the Environment and a political science major from the class of 1988. And he noted that he's been very concerned about recent reversals in Brazil, and also that he's been most encouraged by the impressive people that he's met while working in that region. He just wanted to make sure that he had shared quickly those couple of quick thoughts, and we may have a chance to return to those more as themes as we hear from our panelists. Okay, turning to the folks who are here, we have John Reed, who is the founder and former president of the Conservation Strategy Fund, which is an award-winning organization that uses economic analysis and education to advance nature conservation. He's currently an advisor to the Chicago Field Museum and Neotero, which is a new foundation focused on indigenous stewardship of vital ecosystems. He's also a co-author, just very recently, of a New York Times op-ed on the importance of big forests. He holds a degree in public policy from Harvard and an undergraduate degree in English and Spanish from Amherst College. Foster Brown is an environmental geochemist whose work is dedicated to protecting the people and resources of the Western Amazon. He is currently a member of the Woods Hole Research Center and a professor at the Federal University of Acre. He's spent more than 20 years also teaching at Brazil's Fluminense Federal University. Foster has worked with rural workers and leaders of indigenous local communities to understand and respond to climate change. He holds a master's and PhD degrees from Northwestern University and created his own major at Amherst College. So thank you very much, and I'm going to turn it over to our panelists.
Thank you, Kate. It's fantastic to be here. Thanks for almost filling this huge lecture hall. It's really incredible, astonishing to see all of you out here to hear, listen about the Amazon. And I've got to say that it is a long-held dream of mine to be a warm-up band for Foster Brown, a real towering figure and guru in our field of sustainable development in the Amazon. So this is a wonderful opportunity for me. Kate, how do I get onto my presentation?
Exit, close, and you should go down here. Here we go.
While we're getting to my presentation, I just want to say how fantastic I think it is that Amherst College has an environmental studies major that brings together philosophy, economics, science, something that in 1988, when I graduated from here, we didn't even have the tools to conceive of, and it's a reality here. And I especially hope that the economic side of it gets more and more infused with the environmental enthusiasm that you bring, Kate. So fantastic. Congratulations. Kate described three questions she asked us to address. One is the kinds of work that we've contributed to in the Amazon. Second, the challenges we've faced. And third, the inspiration and motivation that we get for this work. So I'm going to start with the third question, do the second, start with the third, then go to the first, the second, and come back to motivation. So I want to do motivation twice in this talk, so it's an extra motivational talk. and I start with this slide just to make it real and remind myself and reflect on why I work in ecosystems like the Amazon Basin. And the Amazon is a place that is both sort of unfathomably big and unfathomably small and detailed. It's kind of like the universe in that way. And being in it and experiencing the churn and the chaos of it, and also the incredible, exquisite order and pattern of it, is something that's part of the motivation, but it's also that ecosystem is still completely fused with human culture. There are people who, in this particular forest, which is in the Peruvian Amazon in the Piedmont of the Andes, there are indigenous people who live without contact with the outside world. They live in this forest with their whole livelihood completely rooted in it. But there are also millions of indigenous people and other peoples in the Amazon whose lives are inextricably woven into this incredible ecosystem. So it's not just nature, but it's just this incredible tapestry of culture and nature that's a living, breathing thing. So I wanted to set the table with that and then describe a little bit of my own involvement in the Amazon. So, let's see, yes. So this is what my work in the Amazon looks like. It's not a swashbuckling guy in jungle fatigues out there with equipment measuring the size of trees. I got into conservation through an economics entry point. And as you heard from my bio, I had no economics background when I walked across the stage here at Amherst College. I had to do some remedial education to go on that path. What I did have, though, is Portuguese. I studied that while I was at college. And of course, that delivered me to Brazil, a country that I fell in love with. But the economics lens, I became more and more convinced, was something that was sorely missing in the practice of conservation, which was largely dominated by people from the natural sciences who had gone out, inspired many of them by some of the great Victorian naturalists who went all over the Amazon to discover species and really revel in the wonders of this ecosystem. But the fact is that the Amazon and other ecosystems throughout the world, and the ones in your backyard, are all subject to a matrix and a network of economic pressures. Lots of people want to use ecosystems for lots of different things. And in the conservation movement, this was a huge blind spot. So that's what motivated me to create an organization that would be dedicated to the education of professionals who work in the environmental or conservation field in the basics of economics, economic literacy and analysis as applied to nature. So we gave many, many classes in the Amazon and other places throughout the world where people would get down and dirty with the numbers, crunch through spreadsheets, learn how to calculate an internal rate of return for something like a Brazil nut harvesting operation, or for things like mega dams in the Amazon, and in so doing, really become participants in the development discussions of the countries where they live and work and vote and have standing. In the map that Kate showed at the outset, there are sort of big areas where deforestation has taken hold in the Amazon. These are largely along corridors where there are major infrastructure development that was put into the basin during the military dictatorship in the 70s with really no plan about how to zone the land and use it and distribute it among development and conservation uses. So it's a total disaster that continues to be repeated today with poorly planned infrastructure projects. So part of the work really ended up being in the Amazon, bringing economic transparency to the decisions about public investments and infrastructure that could be a huge deciding factor about the fate of a certain part of the Amazon. A second big area of work.
John, do you want the lights on?
No, that's fine. The figure on the left is the chief of the Surui people. The figure on the right is Jessica Reed, my daughter, class of 2020, who's pouring drinks at the 1988 tent tonight. So if you want to meet her, that's Jessica when she's 14 getting painted by Chief Almir. And we're commemorating the completion of a business plan for a new business for his people. So another stream of work is really working with people who need sustainable development alternatives and going through the ABCs of financial analysis and business planning to figure out whether there's a market, what kind of skills they're going to need to build, what kind of infrastructure they need, doing the numbers and figuring out the viability of those sort of enterprises. So that's just a quick thumbnail sketch of the kind of work. I don't have a slide to show challenges because, you know, it was so visually unappealing when I started to think of all the bad things I could put on a slide, like so some of the politicians in power in Brazil right now, you know, smoldering jungle, that kind of thing. You guys have all seen that. But I would say, just to summarize it and kind of put it in my language, there is a whole stream of challenges that stem from just the market forces, the free markets and the demand for resources. And you see this particularly strongly in minerals today. In the western Andean part of the Amazon, oil and gas, and timber. And this is just the world demanding products that happen to be in these forests. There's a whole second stream, which is bad policies, where resources are being allocated by acts of public policy and infrastructures being planned without a full accounting of the costs and benefits of those decisions. So on the one hand, there is an imperative to balance the market forces with the non-market benefits that we want out of nature, which has to happen through better public policies. And my only kind of addendum to that is that while there are nefarious forces and sort of political depravity at work here, there's also just humans being humans and trying to live their lives and trying to better their lives. And that's always important to keep in mind. So what gives me hope? Of course, young people. So embarrassing photo number two. This is my father on the left. And we're at the iconic first major ecotourism lodge in Brazil, a place called Mamirauá. And what I find inspiring about this photograph is not my sleeping father, although it was really fun to take him to the Amazon, his first time in South America last year. It's the figures on the right. The young woman is really in the second generation of conservation biologists, Brazilian conservation biologists, arguably generation 2.5, coming up full of enthusiasm, getting highly educated, having great field experience, and feeding into public institutions, academic institutions, nonprofit, and here she's spending a season as a naturalist guide in this reserve. The guy on the right is from the local community, and he is in the second generation of his family working in this business, which is a sustainable business. It feeds the community. It takes care of just a stunning piece of rainforest, and it exposes people like us to the marvels of a flooded forest in Brazil. Continuing on the inspired by youth track, these kids live in the upper Rio Negro region of Brazil. And if Kate maybe goes back to that map at some point, there's this huge region in northwestern Brazil and the bordering part of Colombia, which is a massive indigenously owned and controlled area. And these kids are bridging their family's past, living and cultivating in these forests, and a future in which they're leapfrogging into technology that they can use to tell their stories. And you know, it's not necessarily that kids taking videos is going to save the world, but that their ability for uptake of technology and new ideas is really stunning. And to come to the idea of indigenous peoples that they are slower at learning stuff is totally the wrong idea. And they're doing this at the same time as their dad is making food, basically making cassava meal, which is the staple of their diet, 10 feet away in this age-old traditional way. So the kids give me a lot of inspiration. And really, you know, what I've seen you see incremental kind of ratcheting change in protecting the environment within a generation, and then there are turnovers and sort of quantum leaps. I've seen it in my career in Brazil, and imagine Foster's seen it sort of times two in his. So I want to close the talk and the inspiration theme with just the... It's great to go down and see these places because you realize the absolute magnitude of the good stuff that is still in great shape in the Amazon, and for that matter, in other ecosystems. This is in the same region of the Upper Rio Negro, and the people I just showed you in the previous slides live in these forests, and they own them. You know, under Brazilian law, they sort of 99% own them. And in the bordering part of Colombia, they pretty much 100% own them. You know, remarkably strong land rights. And these forests are producing this sort of trifecta of climate benefits, biodiversity, and preserving cultural diversity, including linguistic diversity. So if that doesn't inspire you, you're a difficult to inspire person. And I'll just say in closing, you know, often people will ask, well, what do I do to help do something about the Amazon? My first answer, and we can talk about this a little more in Q&A, is I say go there. Go to the Amazon. This is Jessica Reed, class of 2020, a slightly younger age, on the Tapajós River in Brazil, having a great time on a boat trip, and you could be doing the same. So thanks very much.
John, thank you for giving such an exciting and inspiring talk. John's work in the Conservation Strategy Fund has done incredible work in an area that we need a lot, which is the producing the environmental, the economic sustainability of native peoples in the Amazon. And it's a task that is, we need much more, we need many more of you. And I'm just very happy to be here and be able to divide this time with you. I want to thank Kate for this opportunity, too, for coordinating it and for this opportunity to share with you some things that have happened. I think all of us are here for the reunion to think back a few years. I mean, I'm the time travel that I'm going in, I remember being in this place more than 40 years ago, and it's about the same. I did want to talk a little bit about this guy who's sitting there. He's 8 years younger at the time, in Iberia. Iberia, anybody been to Iberia? Has anybody been here to Iberia? Okay. Iberia is basically at the end of the world in Peru. And I put this up to show you behind, there's a painting. And that painting was commissioned for a local artist by the local priest, who was basically putting into this painting, think globally, act locally, because the local signs are on the side. You see the deforestation and the factors. And one of the themes I want to talk about is the importance of wherever we are, make the link between the global and the local. And how I got there is because I wanted to learn Spanish. But it wasn't Peru, per se. I was finishing my doctorate, and I figured, boy, I'd really like to learn a language. And I didn't do too well in French. I went to France during my Amherst years, and it was a great experience, and I wanted to repeat it in Hispanic America. And I couldn't get a job there. I went to Washington. I could get a job working in Washington, but not there. And then something came up in Brazil, and so I had the opportunity to learn Portuguese. And so I went down, spent 2 years, and then come back and get a job and do things here. Well, that was in 1980. So it's been more than just 2 years. And this is how some of our paths work. And when I Ended up in this area because of some colleagues at the Federal University of Acre, when I was helping to do a mapping of the Chico Mendes Reserve, asked me to help, and I was to spend a year, and that was 26 years ago. So that's my attempt at career planning. So I'd like to give you a taste of let's see if I can figure this thing out. Oh, okay. Okay, got it. Okay, now to put it in a relative perspective, what I'm working in is a tri-national area, which is basically where Bolivia, Peru, and Brazil meet. It's called Southwestern Amazon. And it's the political units of Madre de Dios in Peru, Acre in Brazil, and Panama in Bolivia. And we call it the MAP or MAP region. And to give you an idea of the scale, if you were to put the continental U.S., it would cover basically this area of the Brazilian Amazon, and the Amazon basin is actually larger than the continental U.S. And our corner is the equivalent of New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Looking at it in a closer viewpoint, you can see this area, and it has in common, it is a forest cover, tropical forest cover in this area. And you can see where Iberia is on that, which was really the end of the world until about 10 years ago when the Interoceanic Highway was completed. To give you an idea of one of the challenges, this is one of the challenges. If you look at the white, the clear white, let me see if this shows up. Those clear white things are cloud. This is smoke. And it's smoke levels that are well above what would be the maximum permissible level for one day. And this happened in 2005 for a month. And so we had a severe drought. This was the epicenter of the drought. And we had major forest fires that covered large parts of this region. So that's just to give a little bit about the challenges that we're facing. And I'm going to take a more biophysical route. And what we're talking about is climate change. Here's a quick list. I will not discuss it in detail. The 2005, we had in the MAP region nearly 500,000 hectares of standing rainforest that burned. Okay? And if you were to do it in an environmental services perspective using fines, it would be equivalent to $150 million worth of damage. We had another, and that was to be a 1-in-100-year drought. Well, we had a similar drought in 2010. Which covered 140,000 acres just in Acre. And if you look at what happens from 1914, 1915, 1916, 1917, we are having a series of extreme climate events. So it's a place where a lot of things are happening. This leads to a concern that we may be going in a pathway where the dry season is extending, and the possibility that we may be at a point of collapse, or going to a point of collapse of portions, or large portions, of the Amazon forest. This is not good news. I did want to say that this is a bad news, good news story. This is the bad news. Okay. And so we're faced with big challenges of change. And coming up with how to deal with that is where the second part of the title was thinking about optimism. And we began, well, there's a little story that goes back, and Ed Rosenthal here was my classmate, and we shared TD together for 3 years, 2.5 years. And his daughter, Amy, came to visit me in the early 2000s, and got involved in this area, and eventually ended up becoming a key person for this project that comes about. So sometimes you invest, person comes along, and then 15 years later, they are able to collaborate with you. And we've just begun an educational program with the idea of the following. We've got a planet to take care of, but the way to take care of this planet is starting out in your local backyard. And so we just, and one of the things that people, if you talk carbon, you talk other subjects, people don't get it really very well, but water, everybody gets. And so we're using water as a focus and also as a hook to get people thinking about changing the way that we're dealing with the planet. And so this is a tri-national campaign that's just begun, which is, what it's translated is in the Portuguese and Spanish here, but it's taking care of the Earth's water starting in the MAP region. It was interesting talking with the teachers because we're doing this with the school systems. And and on the World Water Day, we launched this campaign in March. We had several thousand students involved. And so all of a sudden, we're into a big multiplying factor that can help us think about coming up with the solutions to some of the problems that we're facing here. And one of the specific things that we're looking at is where Peru, Brazil, and Bolivia come together, which is a trinational river basin. It's one of the few trinational river basins on a small scale in the Amazon. And we're using this as sort of taking care of our backyard. It is the 70s slogan of think globally, act locally. And in this case, it's an area that's about a third the size of Massachusetts. But it brings together people from Peru, Brazil, and Bolivia. And so we're thinking about this as a first step to going to the larger basin, which is the Amazon basin, which, by the way, is the world's largest river basin, and it's the largest, it's about half of the remaining tropical rainforest in the world. And then thinking that as a hook to go and thinking about for the planet. Well, this may be a bit delusional on our part. But optimism can be a factor, and I did want to put this in, that, and it would give you a plug for philosophy into your program. And so I won't work on I won't attempt to pronounce the Latin, but Virgil was reported to saying, they can because they think they can. And I just wanted to cite two examples, recent examples of that. One is, think about it, in the mid-2000s, we just had a war with Iraq, and Saddam Hussein was the critical. And then they say, he won't believe this, but I just got in touch with a fortune teller who said that the next president will have a middle name Hussein. And don't forget, enemy number one was Osama bin Laden, and the last name, Obama. And you say, there's no way this guy is going to make it. There's no way. And so if he had asked me, I said, don't try. But he had optimism, and it made it happen. Another person in the 2012, 13, 14, somewhere in there, was the star of a reality show called The Apprentice. And, he got into his mind that he wanted to be president. And, how can a reality star, head of a reality TV show, become president? Well, we know it's possible. So two examples of optimism that seemed to be delusional at the time ended up, we now have presidents for the last 9 years because of that type of optimism. So I'd like to leave the message is that things can change, and there's reasons why we can make these things. So whether you believe you can do a thing or not, you're right. And I'd like to believe that we can change the way that we're handling the planet and also changing the way that we're handling the Amazon. Here's a sign of optimism. This is on the bridge between Peru and Brazil. And it was World Water Day, and two groups of students came for both sides, each of them carrying their national flag. And at the middle, and the river that I showed you can only be managed, the river basin can only be managed if Brazil, Bolivia, and Peru get together and work together. And so they came and they ended up, it was a symbolic ceremony of them exchanging the flags. So here is a Brazilian boy with a Peruvian flag and the Peruvian girl with a Brazilian flag, symbolizing this is what we need to do to take care of water of the planet and starting in the MAP region. Motivation, I should have pointed out the first slide, I had vovô on my t-shirt, which means grandfather. But my grandchildren are definitely motivation. And a little calculation, they'll be my age around 2080, when the world population is estimated to be close to 11 billion people. We're at 7.6, I guess, right now. And since many of you, I'm in the, this is not a young group, so I'm sure many of you can relate to this. But when I was born, the world population total was 2.5 billion. So we're going to put, in the lifetime of my grandchildren, another 2.5 or more billion people on this planet, if trends continue. So there's a lot of things we need to do so that our grandchildren, the grandchildren of everyone, can have a chance for a better life. I'm not Catholic, I'm agnostic, but I am ended up involved with a lot of Catholic priests recently. And one who I'm a real fan is a former bouncer, Pope Francis. And I would recommend, if you would like to read a document that sketches out the challenges, Laudato Si is definitely a good read. I've read it about three or four times, and each time I read it, I see something new in it. And he points out that we're facing not only with an environmental crisis, but also a social crisis, and actually they are two sides of the same coin. I've had the chance to be influenced by a Catholic friar by the name of Heitor Turini, who came to Acre in 2050 and was basically embodied many of the things of what I found in Pope Francis. And the other thing is, it's one thing to engage in a struggle, it's another to engage in a struggle and want to win. And I'd like to thank my teammates of rugby because we ended up winning a game. And it taught me how important it was. And actually, I had a chance to make a try. These are some of the motivations that we were asked, that Kate asked to put us in, and so they go from the Pope to a rugby team, okay? And but to also, the meeting is, yes, we're talking about the Amazon, but in fact, we're talking about the world and the challenges that all of us have. And this, you guys are extremely important. There are movers and shakers. All of us are here are certain means movers and shakers in individual lives and in collective adventures. And so I would encourage you to really think about being optimistic and figure out what we can do to make things better. Okay, thank you very much.
Try to open it up to the audience for some questions so that we can hear further from our speakers about the issues that you might be interested in, questions that those slides sparked, or things you'd like to know more about, and perhaps so that we can get a few different ideas out there. If there's two or three people that want to ask comments or ask questions or make comments, then we can collect some of those and our panelists can respond to a set of those. Yes.
I have two separate questions. One on the sustainability side, what are the projects that are being successful that are local and perhaps go beyond local? I don't know what the economic goal is bringing in our circles there.
Do we have another question that we want to collect now, and then you guys can respond slowly? Yeah. Sure.
What percent of the Amazon is protected, and how solidly is it protected?
Maybe we should start answering because I didn't bring anything to write with.
Go for it.
To your first question, this isn't a comprehensive answer, but in the work that we've done with local communities and indigenous peoples on enterprise ideas, the most successful ones are ones where it's an existing activity that they're familiar with, and the market recognizes, and it's a matter of helping them get the product to market more efficiently, organize the management of the resource more sustainably, as opposed to some efforts we've made where we bring something totally novel. And tourism is a good example. Tourism, there are some bright spots and some successes with indigenous tourism, but there are a lot of failed projects as well where it's too much too fast in terms of assimilating new ideas, needing new skill sets, having to develop markets for places that the tourism going public doesn't know about. Whereas things like managing fish or managing Brazil nuts, which can be big businesses. I've seen more success in those areas, managing timber even. Foster?
I'll go at a different scale, perhaps, to respond to that. The state of Acre is in an unusual circumstance. It's had a stable government. The same party has been in power for almost 20 years. And it was a very enlightened government all this time. So they've become the leading example of non-national governments negotiating RED, reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation, which basically involves payments you've reduced the deforestation that you would have emitted. It's kind of a crazy scheme, but if you had continued as normal, situation as normal, you would have emitted so many million tons of carbon. But because of the actions that you're taking, you're reducing that, and that is a carbon credit, which then can be either used in a market situation or perhaps, in this case, with some development banks as sort of a credit in which the state government has received money for this. It is not something that looks for the long, long term, but for the next 10 years. And so this has been one of the designs. The other is part of the educational program is to make people realize that their rainfall is dependent on trees. I mean, there's certain, you have to deal with what's in people's heads. I used to think that there was one reality. Now I know, at least among humans, there's 7 billion realities. And the realities that people have there is that you clean the forest, take out forest away, you plant your crops, and that's development. And it's taking a while, and that's what the educational program we're having right now is teaching people. You cut the forest, you're cutting the pumps, that the biotic pumps that maintain the forest functioning in the rainfall. And so you don't want to do that at a time when global environmental or global climate change is tending to expand the dry season periods. It's sort of like you're putting dirt in a wound. And so so part of that aspect of sustainability is also thinking of different models of how you use the land and the reasons why you would want to do that.
Thank you. That's great. And the second question, I think, was about the percent protected or some characterization of how much has been protected. And I'm going to pass you some correct. Remember, recycled letterhead okay. And a purple pen here.
This isn't going to help me answer that question, but I'm going to hazard 50% as more or less the ballpark, and that's between indigenous reserves
and protected areas of various different categories. So there are strictly protected national parks where it even our parks pale by comparison in terms of the strictness. There are large areas in Brazil where even researchers can't go. And there's a lot of debate about the merits of having that level of strict protection. And it goes all the way to areas that people can live in and use for logging, but under sustainable management plans. And there's definitely not enough resources going into the agencies and the people on the ground protecting these areas. But there is research where the kind of the spatial data of deforestation have been analyzed, and the presence of an indigenous reserve or a protected area is analyzed as one of the variables in a regression about whether or not a particular spot is likely to be deforested. And both have a significant impact on avoiding deforestation. The indigenous reserves have a more pronounced impact on avoiding deforestation than the strict, any category of protected area.
And I actually just wanted to jump in super quickly to say that this tension between long-term protection and solving market failures and providing local livelihoods, those three goals are hard to achieve with a single policy. And we actually did a lot of work in Mexico trying to compare payments for ecosystem services, these red-type policies, with the protected areas in Mexico, and found sort of trade-offs between those three objectives, that the payments do relatively well in terms of supporting local livelihoods and in the short term reducing some deforestation. The protected areas probably will do better in the long run and can protect more against deforestation, but are less good in terms of the livelihoods. So there's really tensions and need to figure out where the different policies can work well interfacing with each other. Okay, we've got lots of questions in the back. So how about blue shirt, and then green shirt, and then red sleeves?
Yes. Am I blue shirt?
Yes.
Okay. Are PSI indexes published in any of the countries that you all work in?
PSI?
Yeah.
What's that?
Can I say something? That's an excellent question. Whenever I don't understand, I tell my grad students, compliment the person. Say, what is a PSI?
I'm not sure what the actual acronym, but it is having to do with particulates. You showed a slide of smoke.
Yes.
And that is the PSI index. So for countries that have slash and burn economies, there's a lot of smoke in the air.
Right.
So smoke is really bad. You're talking about it being very unhealthy. Well, when you're in a country where the PSI index is 360, for example, you have to wear a face mask. But it is an education tool.
It's a very powerful education. When people can't breathe, they really, they're very attentive as to you talk about it.
So I guess PSI indexes are not?
Well, we use particulate matter in terms of micrograms per cubic meter. And we've just started a program which, if you look at purpleair.com, you can see a map. And it used to be for measuring that, we had done work with INPE using sort of atmospheric models, and it was a rough idea. But now, with the Internet of Things, you can buy for $250 a system that used to cost $20,000, and it will measure every 3 seconds the concentration. And so we're now putting those things in the region, so to be able to quantify it more precisely. But the health issues, the estimates we had for the 2005, that period, as I mentioned, we had over a month of smoke above what it should have been. And so we're trying to get a handle on the measurement side, and then that translates into better estimates as to the cost of that for society as well. And then using that as one more reason why you don't want to burn.
Yes, it was very effective. We lived in Southeast Asia for a long time, and Indonesia is quite well known as things like burning. And television in Singapore, for example, would publish And it also indigenously started to make a big impact on what was happening and the understanding of the repercussions.
That's great. Thank you.
That's wonderful, and thank you. We're trying to go in that direction. It's one of the reasons, about every 5 years, we have a very bad period of smoke. And unfortunately, it's likely that those will come in more frequent.
Thanks. So let's just collect the next two so they can think about it a little bit.
Okay. You mentioned that you were really in favor of ecotourism. And I was wondering if you could, for us who haven't been there, give any words of wisdom about how to get there, where to go, and how long it takes.
Okay, thanks. Yes, sir.
I want to ask about the perspective and economics of solar in the region, and if that's a factor in deforestation and any hope for future.
Okay, those are great questions. So we've got a question about ecotourism, a question about the future of solar. Does anyone want to add one more here?
Yeah, my question would just be a follow-up to the article you showed. Showing the last, I think it was 5 years or so, with the tipping point, seems like
there's a
real drought situation almost every single year, and it's getting worse. Are we at a tipping point? And I guess the question is, I would assume that the tipping point will be decided one way or the other based on really global climate change issues. So if, for example, you were told to be successful in getting everybody in the region to do everything right, would there still be
So, John, do you want to take first stab at
But I want to make sure to hear Foster's answer about tourism. I want to know where to go in Acre. we could share the names of some places that that we've been and like. I've been. Most of the time we're working and don't get to go to all the ecotourism destinations, but a couple favorites of mine are the one that I showed in the photograph, the Mamirawa Floating Lodge, and that was it is a marriage of a tourism operation and a scientific research institute, sustainable development institute. And it's just really remarkable to experience the flooded forest. That forest floods up to about 30 or 40 feet high on the trunks of the trees seasonally. So there's a flooded season experience where you're paddling among the trees. The trails are navigated by canoe. And it's an area very, very rich in wildlife because it's on the main stem of the Amazon, which is a very nutrient-rich river. So there's tons of fish, tons of animals, there are bugs, and birds, fantastic place. In Bolivia, there's a terrific place called the Chalalan Lodge, which is in the Medidi National Park, which I think its partisans say is the most biodiverse park on Earth. And it's an indigenous-run operation. Very nice. You're in really... extremely well-preserved rainforest that's distinct from the Amazon, the Amazon plain. You're kind of right at that first slope of the Andes. So fantastic scenery, topography, and a great setting. So those are two I'd throw out there. Where would you go?
In the MAP region, near Puerto Maldonado, the capital of Madre de Dios, there are several eco-lodges, and they're fantastic. That part of the Amazon is sort of paradise and hell, one next to the other, because the hell part is the mining operations. Illegal, informal, all the stuff to the Wild West is right there. And so you can fly in, and you look... In one side of the window, you're seeing basically a ravaged Earth, something that looks almost like the surface of the moon. And then on the other side, this pristine forest. But I recommend it. There's some very nice places to visit. In Acre, there are certain indigenous groups who have, for their festivals, have brought in tourists, and it seems to be operating, but it's not something I can, I don't have personal experience on. On a solar energy basis, I can say we've got solar energy for our house, and because of we were lucky on the design, we haven't had to put in air conditioning, so we are actually exporting energy. But 2 years ago, when we put it in, we were the first residents in Rio Branco, and that is not good. If we're, this time 2016, you're the first resident in a tropical city to put in, and so there hasn't been the encouragement to go to the solar energy route up to now in the in our part of the Amazon. I must qualify all that I say. I'm a provincial, local guy. I only know a certain part of the Amazon. It's a big place. The Amazon dieback hypothesis is what we're talking about, and that came to the fore about 2003 or 4 with a paper by Peter Cox on some modeling, and it looked like the droughts would become more frequent to the extent that you've basically gone to a savanna environment and the rainforest couldn't handle it, and the forest would die back and be replaced by some sort of savanna-like vegetation. That is, on a personal basis, this is what I'm seeing. I cannot prove that what I showed you there is a result of anthropogenic climate change. It could be natural processes, but it is consistent to what we expect. And the other thing is, it's not only local or global. The deforestation in Pará must be affecting our rainfall. We just don't have the registry, the data sufficient to look at it. But the river flows in eastern Pará have increased over the last 2 decades, which means that there's not the same transpiration that's occurring, which would be supplying rainfall for our area. And so it's global with the CO2 effects. It's also regional from the land use variations. And every year, another piece is taken home. So I give talks and often I leave depressed, and the whole class and the whole my audience leaves depressed. And so that's why I like putting up the kids up there and talking about some of the good things that are going on and the importance of optimism. So the solar energy potential is very big. It's not being used right now. The dieback, I'm working with some people on an article on the socioeconomic. It happens in the best of families. Mm-hmm. And because we're trying to quantify what would be the impact. And it's in a few trillions of dollars in terms of the impact and order of magnitude. I hope that answers the question. The other is, yes, we all know that if everybody doesn't get involved, you don't get a solution. But if you don't do your own backyard, then you can't complain about the others.
I just wanted to add on the solar. I think there's huge potential. And right now, in isolated communities in the Amazon, I'm thinking of those more than the big cities like Rio Branco, because how they get their energy is either not at all or with diesel generators. And the diesel generators have particulate emissions and make a hell of a lot of noise and use expensive fuel, which is subsidized to varying degrees in the basin. But there is, with the fall in the price of solar panels, I think there's a huge potential for it to be embraced in communities that are not attached to the grid, which is a lot of places.
I asked you because Tony Sieber, the Stanford Business School, makes the argument for many countries now that solar is cheaper than all other forms.
Yeah.
It's an optimistic thing. We have the global warming. And a sunny island will be the very first place, which exactly what you said, will remove diesel and fossil fuel sources.
Yeah.
And economically, it's there.
Yeah.
So I wondered, is that hope for the Amazon?
I think it is. It's not, you know, it's not going to stop the deforestation of the Amazon, but it can improve the environmental quality of the Amazon and take away one more source of greenhouse gas emissions.
Let's do two last questions, and then I think we're going to be out of time. So let's hear these questions.
On a macro level, I'm wondering, is the local water source, surface water, that's treated, and how is sewage treatment done in, you know, towns or communities, and where does the effluent go from that? Is it treated or right into the river system, or is it somehow processed and discharged?
And my question, Butch, is about cultural change. I share your enthusiasm for Pope Francis, but I wonder how much evidence is there of changing the attitudes of people in Brazil and toward Brazil in terms of their valuation of natural conservation more than they used to. Do you see an impact of love advocacy among Brazilians?
Okay.
Do you want to take a first crack?
Okay. Last week, I was giving a series of talks to high school teachers, and we talked about the toilet law. And the toilet law. Yeah. Well, it's also the law of the gas tank. So, well, the toilet law is when you hit the plunger and it goes someplace. So, and when you fill up a tank, gas tank, and then it goes dry, it just didn't disappear. It's basically teaching them the laws of conservation of mass. And the toilet law is really important because the whole treatment aspect, there's very little treatment done in Amazon cities. And that's a big health issue. And people, and it's a perception issue as well. In the specific area of the Acre River, it's a high sediment load. And so typically, the smaller cities have used small tributaries as the water source. But as our droughts have become more frequent, and I don't know if I put it up on the slide, but in the last 2 or 3 years, several of the smaller cities have had their water supply collapse. And so people, it's the 2x4 form of education. I don't know if you heard about 2x4. Get over to hit by the head with a 2x4 and the person, you know, pays more attention. And so I also work with civil defense. And so now when we go and we talk about water supplies and resilience, people have been hit by the 2x4 and they're paying attention. So I would say that there's a perspective of, there's a receptivity, and they're wanting to know solutions. If we just talk about the problems and we point out, you know, if the Chinese and the Americans don't get their act together, it's all over, but we can't do anything about it, so what do? Let's go have a beer. You know, that's the solution is go have a beer. But if you're part of the problem and you can see parts of the solutions and you can also think about, and everybody realizes social media, you get a good example, and the next day there's 100,000 people know about it. So there's a lot of power that exists that can multiply that we didn't have when we were here in college. And so there's a lot of power, there's things we can do, and if everyone does their part, then we do have solutions. But if you don't think so, we don't have a solution.
So I wanted to add, in response to your question about the evolution of Brazilian attitudes, something remarkable happened last year when the president of Brazil, who's established himself as no friend of the environment, proposed or did by fiat open a 5 million hectare area for mining, and it's an area with indigenous people making their homes there. And the details are a little complicated, but the reaction from Brazilian society was swift and incredibly powerful, where there was this remarkable video made by a bunch of notable Brazilians within, it seemed like, 48 hours, put on the internet, went viral, and I don't know how long it took, but it wasn't long before that decree was reversed. It became politically untenable to be doing something that Brazilian society had kind of, you know, spoken up and said, this is not what we want. So that is inspiring that people care and they're finding their ways in local settings and also in national settings to express themselves.
Thank you all very much for coming.